This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Rising seas, weather, famine and disease. Amazon, Borneo, Armageddon, embers close, slash and burn, no return, there's chains on in the Congo. We didn't start the fire, but now it's really burning, and the temperature's turning. We didn't start the fire, no, we didn't light it, but we're trying to fight it. Flash floods, danger zones, hurricanes and cyclones, wildfires, burning pollution.
Talkie Girls Grammar School, Devon.
Acapulco, Mexico, wiped out without warning. Sea ice crash at both poles. Scorched record October heat in Africa, South America, and globally. As environmental crises multiply, cries for a government solution get louder. Will the response make it worse? Is the Green New Deal a solution or another problem? Rethinking our options first with Dr. Ted Trainer, founder of The Simpler Way and Pig Face Point, Australia. From Cambridge University, political economist Dr. Jeremy Green finds dangerous myths in the New Deal for an overloaded system. Look out for the growth monster wearing green clothes. I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Is the Green New Deal possible? Can we really keep growing without wrecking more of the ecosphere? What is the addictive need to always promise people more? Why not live a simpler, happier way of life? Dr. Ted Trainer has led that exploration. Ted is an independent scholar based in Sydney, Australia. He retired as lecturer at the School of Social Work, University of New South Wales. Trainer published numerous books and articles on personal sustainability and community building, including Pig Face Point, an alternative lifestyle education site near Sydney. He has published on the Green New Deal as well. Ted Trainer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Ted, we're going to give the listeners a four-step process here. First, we need your assessment of where we are now. Then I have questions about your 2022 technique critique of the Green New Deal. So as a start, most of our listeners are driving around in gas cars. They fly sometimes, they buy lots of stuff. And meanwhile, billions of people in less developed countries see that wonderful life in advertisements and movies and TV. They want the same, they want it quickly, even during this time of crises. Ted, how do you see the situation we are in now?
Well, it's grossly unsustainable, the way of life we have. And, of course, you just described the way of life that maybe a billion or 2 billion people have. And even they are stressed and many of them struggling. But the possibility of extending that way of life to the 10 billion we'll have soon is totally impossible. No chance whatsoever. One of my papers details a numerical argument that looks at the estimates of resources available and so on and concludes that we have a per capita resource consumption rate in rich countries that is probably around 10 times the consumption rate that all the world's people could sustainably rise to. Now, most people have no idea about that. But most people know we've got terrible problems: ecological resource, conflict over resources, third world being deprived, etc. But they don't understand just how far beyond sustainable and just ways our lifestyles in rich countries are. Now, if you accept that, or if you find the numerical arguments, which are not just put forward by me, of course, if you find those arguments plausible, you have no alternative but to face up to dramatic reductions in our consumption rates. And luckily now there is a rapidly growing degrowth movement worldwide. In other words, people are starting to realise what I've just said is valid and starting to grapple with how the devil can we transition to better ways. Very central in the predicament is the kind of economy we've got. It is, of course, an economy that must grow. It cannot even stand still because that means recession, bankruptcies, unemployment and so on. let alone could it face up to dramatic reductions in the amount of producing and consuming going on. So what we're faced with here is system change of an enormous kind, as distinct from or in addition to changes in lifestyles. We can't solve these problems just by trying to cut our, our driving and our luxury tourism and so on. We have to make enormous changes in the kind of systems we have, and the economic system is one of the is perhaps the most important, but also which was something that must change pretty obviously is our value system, our culture. We are not going to move at all in the right direction till people realise that the pursuit of affluence and growth and wealth and property is a dreadful mistake. It's not just impossible, it's not just absurd, it's now suicidal, because that whole syndrome is what's generating the big global problems that look like they'll bring us down very, very shortly.
Well, on the economy, no one gets elected promising people they must live with less. Instead, from Europe to Korea, the Green New Deal is popular because it promises growth without the sin. In May 2022, you published a paper, A Technical Critique of the Green New Deal. What is your critique, Ted Trainer?
There is no possibility whatsoever of solving the big global problems and our own problems, like wrecking the environment, unless we degrow enormously. So it all goes back to that basic argument, and you have got to look at that carefully and decide whether it's valid or not. Now, there's a lot of people, not just me, who are publishing heavy academic papers saying that it is valid. We cannot have growth and solve the problems. The basic assumption in that version of the Green New Deal, which assumes that growth is possible, is a decoupling faith. The view, the assumption that we can separate growth in output, wealth and all that from the amount of resources being used and the environmental damage that's going on. Now, that assumption is totally false. And there is now a very heavy literature showing that you can decouple in particular areas, like you can produce carpets with less waste than you used to. But the overall issue is what matters, and that is whether GDP, the total amount of producing and consuming going on, can continue to go up while we bring those resource and environmental impacts not just down, but down enormously. The World Wildlife Fund has been telling us for years that we're using nearly twice as many resources as is sustainable. Now, if you draw a graph of this, you have GDP to 2050 almost trebling, going up and up. And do you think you can take the resource use point on that graph that we presently have down to half its size, half its height, while that GDP goes up? It's just absurd. And we've got lots of heavy papers. There's one that has looked at 800 studies and concludes that decoupling is not being achieved and it is not remotely likely to be achieved. So the GND is really a stab in the dark estimate, gesture of faith, just saying, oh, we technical advance can do it. You know, we'll be right. We don't have to change your lifestyles. We don't have to change your economy. Well, my article is trying to summarise the scientific technical reasons why that faith is not just utterly mistaken, but an act of bad faith. It's dishonest. Now, if you look at the evidence, the science, and all the papers coming out, you realise you cannot hold that faith. And that means that you have to face up to transitioning lifestyles and systems to ways which enable us to live well on very, very low resource use rates and environmental damage. And our simpler way position is that that is achievable. Indeed, we see the simpler way as a path to liberation. It would free us from the consumer capitalist rat race, where we all work far too hard and consume far too much, to ways which enable a very high quality of life with nothing like as much consumption. But I hasten to add that the transition is enormously big and difficult, and we do not have a good chance of achieving it. What we have to do is work very hard to try and do so.
I think that some of the people who champion our current way of life would say, well, degrowth, that sounds great, but really you're talking about billions of people dying in horrible starvation. But you're saying, no, that's not necessary. We do have ways of achieving degrowth. Is that right?
People who are accustomed in a culture that is committed to wealth, affluence, and growth, of course that's an automatic reaction that most people have. They don't want to face up to any reduction in growth and affluence. We're told that the economy must have growth to provide for people and lift people out of poverty. Well, for Pete's sake, just look at our detailed explanations of how we could live well without anything like as much production, consumption, resource use. And we have quite detailed accounts of how we can do that sort of thing. So hopefully you and I can now sort of get into a bit of that detail. But firstly, let me say that there are now very rapidly growing movements around the world which are championing versions of the simpler way vision. There's the eco-village movement, there's the degrowth movement, there's the transition towns movement. Now, there's an eco-village in Missouri which is, its mission is to demonstrate how we can live very well on very low resource use rates. The quality of life, according to scientific surveys, in some of the eco-villages that have been studied, is much higher than the average in the US or Australia. And in the eco-village in Missouri, their resource use rates of electricity, water, garbage production and so on, are around 5 to 10% of the US average. Now, there's no mystery in how they do that. They live more simply, they live more cooperatively, and they have very different systems. And the key element in the different system scenario is localism. If you have highly self-sufficient, small, local economies, you can dramatically eliminate so many resource costs. We did a study of egg supply, and we compared the supermarket path with its vast industrial global networks of fishing fleets and agribusiness and battery factory egg production, etc., supermarkets, heaps of transport, energy use, chemicals. We compared that with the energy and dollar costs of backyard and co-op production of eggs. And the multiple is a 100 or more to 1. In other words, if you produce an egg in the backyard, the total running cost and embodied capital cost of that production system is about 1% of what happens in the typical supermarket part. Now, that can be the same in all sorts of other supply chains and industries. For example, you can have a fishing industry in a normal suburban system in fish tanks. Little fish tanks are very highly productive. And one of the implications of the many benefits involved in this approach is that you do not have to produce fertilizers and you do not have to produce and maintain a sewer system, because a local food production system enables you to recycle all the nutrients from kitchens via buckets back to compost heaps and veggie gardens. Now, along with that domestic neighbourhood food production system using many permaculture principles and gardening everything you can get your hands on, like putting orchards in public parks, along with that, we have little farms close by the town or neighbourhood as part of the local economy. Now, that enables you to eliminate vast amounts of production and consumption. Like, you don't need trucks to bring food from the ports to hundreds of kilometres to country towns, because most of that food can be grown, actually grown, in the town. And again, we have scientific studies. I've done one of my own local suburb, which finds that nearly all the food needed could actually be produced in intensive systems within the area of the town, and then out in those local farms. So there are terrific ways of doing these things, of cutting the resource demands and the ecological impact right down, and they're being practiced here and there around the world, and many terrific examples in places like disadvantaged Detroit suburbs.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Ted Trainer. Ted is the founder of The Simpler Way, and you could perhaps look for this book published in 2020, A Simpler Way, Collected Writings of Ted Trainer. That's where I sort of bit into all this. Now, I have to say, Ted, that I've seen some of this before in the Back to the Land movement of the 1970s and transition towns, as you mentioned. But honestly, those social experiments haven't really caught on so far. The masses have not followed. Have we learned from the earlier trials? And are you offering something different with The Simpler Way?
No, I don't think it's basically different. And of course, these things have not caught on. Of course, in a culture that is obsessed with affluence and growth and is stuck with a economic and political system which must have growth or people get unemployed and dumped, that's not surprising that it hasn't shot the lights out. The critique of growth is only about 50 to 70 years old, and in the first, say, 40, 50 years of it, there were only a few pathetic little efforts to draw attention to the stupidity of growth and the availability of other ways. What is remarkable is that since about 2000, actually, it has rocketed away. It's really taken off now, and especially evident in the degrowth movement. What we think is going to happen, we have very little doubt that this society is running into a time of enormous troubles, where things are breaking down. The system is running out of resources. It's creating environmental problems that are hampering it now, like causing climate damage. It's an economic system which heaps wealth on the rich and dumps vast numbers into poverty, and people are getting cranky about that now. And it's only in the last few decades that the discontent has boiled up, generated by the fact that the system's not providing well for people, even in the richest countries. And so you get Trump, you get the discontent of vast numbers of people who are fed up with the system which won't provide for them, and blame the government and then turn to authoritarian, charismatic leaders, and it's happening in Europe too. And that is not surprising. It is not surprising that people haven't flocked to the simpler way, especially when, as I said, the image of high living standards is all we know. It's all we've been taught and practiced until now. But the tide is turning, driven largely by the discontent and also by the achievements of the alternative movements that are demonstrating these things. Let me just point quickly to what I think is the most impressive one I've ever come across, and that's the Catalan Integral Cooperative in Spain. There are thousands of people who are now creating their own social institutions and mechanisms in things like their own unemployment agencies. They get rid of unemployment by creating jobs and allocating people. Their own medical centres, and their own food networks, eye clinics, and all of this is done by volunteers cooperatively, and they flatly refuse to have anything to do with the market or profit motive or the state. So it's opposed to big state socialism as much as anything else. Now, that just shows what miracles can be carried out, and that's not just the only example of its kind. Now, all of that's coming on now, and I have no doubt that we are going to, within decades, be in a hell of a lot of trouble, which may be the end of us. There are many, many books now talking about the imminent collapse of Western civilization, and I think a very plausible argument that that's going to happen. All you can do is commit yourself to trying to prevent it, and the only way to do that is to help stimulate these alternative initiatives and raise awareness about the two things. One, that the current system's no good, it's got to be replaced, and B, that there is an alternative, a simpler one alternative, which actually provides for everyone, solves the big problems, and raises the quality of life. Now, my own view is very pessimistic. I think it's going to be extremely difficult, and it's unlikely that we'll make it. But if the logic of my argument is valid so far, you have no choice but to commit yourself to trying to bring it off. And the thing you have to do in that campaign is simply talk. We have to spread the ideas as far and as much as we can.
Well, I know many people feel only a collapse could wake up everybody else, but collapse keeps postponing itself for decades, creating more damage all the way. In 2016, I did a show called Can We Count on Catastrophe? But I have to say, on the other hand, I recently saw a poll showing almost half of French youth believe that we should only fly twice in a whole lifetime to limit climate emissions. So I know that many, many young people do know what's going on here. The question is, can they get enough power to get simple before collapse forces us into survival living?
Yep, it's a narrow race, isn't it, between the breakdown of things and whether we can get our team together strong enough in time. It's going to be a close thing. You cannot get people to think about these issues unless things do deteriorate. So you have to hope for a Goldilocks recession, that we go down slowly enough so that there's time for people to see the light and start moving to their local systems and co-ops and committees to pick up the responsibility for getting their own neighbourhood and town into better shape, to build the community gardens and so on. Now, it is quite conceivable that those two things will proceed at a good pace. In other words, that the breakdown will be just enough, at just enough speed to push people in the right direction. We don't want it too fast, and of course, you've got a global financial system with an astronomical amount of debt now that can never be paid, and that financial system can go down overnight. So there are reasons to think that it won't be slow and at the pace we need, but you just have to work on the hope that it will be slow enough. Now, I've been in this game for many decades, and I am staggered at the rate at which the forces for good are coming on, and so there are very strong reasons to be optimistic about what we can achieve. And whether you're optimistic or pessimistic, you've got no option, if you've got any responsibility for the world, to get into the game of trying to raise that awareness.
Some pioneers in sustainable living saw themselves making lifeboats for the big crash. They would preserve skills and knowledge of how to live locally and use resources sustainably. I'm sure you see that in your own work, do you?
Yes, but the lifeboat word is a little bit less than ideal, I think. It's pioneering. It's saving the planet the only way it can be saved. And we've got millions of heroes out there who are humble people just plodding away, trying to increase the good things, like more cooperation and participation within the neighbourhood, like building those systems of community gardens, the sharing, and the looking after little old people who are isolated and so on, dropping in on them. That work is what most needs to be done. It's not a matter of risking your life and undergoing hardship and deprivation and fighting at the barricades. And it's not a matter of trying to persuade the state to change. The state governments cannot do these things. This is a grassroots revolution. It can only be carried out by little people and groups, co-ops on the ground, pioneering, setting up the new ways, so that as time goes by, we gain more strength and we take it away from the corporations and the state, and we eventually force the state to come over and serve us rather than trying to prop up the growth economy, because at the moment that's the only way they know to try and fix the problem. So the good things are happening, they're being carried out by little people, and it's very important to get ordinary people to realise how important they are.
Well, I think that some high consumers picture what we're talking about as a huge loss as suffering, but actually, my simple years without electricity, living on the land, are the most vivid in my life. I think we need to communicate that the simpler way can be the happier way.
That's right. That's right. I'm not connected. My house hasn't been connected to the grid. I use 1% of the Australian household per capita electricity use. Produce my own water off the roof, etc., etc. I don't have a TV or a car. My quality of life is very high because I've got lots of interesting things to do, hobbies and so on. Can I tell your listeners that all of this stuff is detailed at thesimplerway.info website, thesimplerway.info, and can you, if you can, Alex, make known the video we've just made on where I live, and it's we've for about 40 years been taking visitors through, demonstrating, illustrating, introducing these sorts of ideas. I think if you just Google YouTube The Simpler Way, a visit, it's a visit to Pigface Point, people will see that. It's 48 minutes, a lot of detail. It's a little bit clunky because it's homemade, but we think it illustrates the virtues of the simpler way and the feasibility, the ways that we can easily build if we want to do it.
I will definitely pass that link on. And as we wrap up here, I know we have a wealth of expertise. Is there anything else that you want to pass on to our listeners?
The only thing I don't think we've stressed enough is that this is not a socialist vision in the common sense. People fear socialism because it implies a big centralised state. Now, the state cannot do these things, and it will not, because, as I said, it's obsessed with cranking up the economy. We have to transcend capitalism. We have to build a new economy which is highly democratic. Those local communities will have to be participatory democracies. So you have town meetings where everybody debates, discusses and decides what I'm going to do with the parking lot now that we don't need it anymore. So the correct term is really anarchism in the classical sense of participatory democracy. So I want to hit on the head the fear that what we're talking about looks like big state totalitarian authoritarian socialism. It's a kind of socialism, but a different kind. And the key concept is democratic, equalitarian, participatory local government by the people.
From Sydney, Australia, we've been speaking with independent scholar, author, and pioneer Dr. Ted Trainer. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org, but first connect with Ted's work at www.thesimplerway.info, Ted Trainer, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. You're doing a good job there.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
The planet is cooking, ice vanishes, storms rage. Many countries promise a Green New Deal as a solution. Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, Jeremy Rifkin, and Robert Pollin want one. But is this just another bad old deal for the climate and the natural world? Can it work? Cambridge professor of political economy Jeremy Green investigated the alluring power of past social success in the Great Depression. His open access paper is called Greening Keynes, Productivist Lineages of the Green New Deal. If this is our big shot, we all need to dig into what that really means. Dr. Jeremy Green, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, a fair guess predicts most of our listeners are not economists. Who was John Maynard Keynes, and why is he back in favor in recent times of crisis?
So John Maynard Keynes was a very influential British economist and also a government official who was very influential both in developing modern macroeconomics in the 20th century, in particular in response to the challenges of the Great Depression, but was also central to steering the UK government's response to the financial economic challenges of the First and Second World Wars. So he's a very unique figure in that he was both a profoundly transformative thinker as one of the founders of modern macroeconomics, but also a practitioner, a policymaker, who was very much connected to the institutions of power.
In 1999, Time magazine included Keynes in its most important people of the century, saying, quote, his radical idea that governments should spend money they don't have may have saved capitalism, end quote. And that was before 2008, when the U.S. government created a $700 billion bailout fund for Wall Street and General Motors. Now, after the massive COVID support spending, Jeremy, I guess everybody listening has experienced the Keynes revival. True?
So to some extent that is true because, of course, one of Keynes's contributions was to reveal the power of money, the power of monetary and fiscal policy to achieve what is considered socially necessary. So his response to the Great Depression was to say, look, what we actually need to do is sort of unshackle our thinking and our practice of how we use money as a tool to achieve certain economic and social outcomes. We need to break away from the constraints of the gold standard and the idea that we need some kind of precious metal backing for the currency. And instead, we should try and be ambitious in using economic policy and economic tools to meet big social challenges like unemployment and to escape from the perils of depression. And because of his counsel that we need to be creative, imaginative, and to expand the boundaries of economic policy during times of crisis, Keynes has become a popular resource for progressive thinkers as they try and navigate different social and economic challenges. But the problem here, of course, is that Keynes, as you pointed out there, was trying to save capitalism. And if, in fact, capitalism itself is a central driver of climate crisis, then that creates a somewhat paradoxical status for his thought as we try and engage with the problem of green transition.
Well, governments knew large and expensive action was needed to combat climate change and even mass extinction of the species. But the global problem has been approached differently in various countries, and there's been little coordination or awareness of what the other was doing. Most American listeners do not know much about the European Green Deal. Could you give us a quick snapshot of the EU's action there?
So the EU is introducing a number of policies under the name of the EU Green Deal, and this is a framework to accelerate decarbonisation in the European Union, also to progress other ideas about sustainability, about the circularity of goods, thinking about some of the environmental foundations of the economy. But this is also a plan that stops well short of some of the sorts of proposals that we've seen in the more intellectual and academic work on the Green New Deal. So there isn't a commitment to full employment. There isn't a strongly redistributive agenda within the European Green Deal. And much of it is geared towards, in fact, making European industry competitive and putting it into a leading position in the quote-unquote green industries of tomorrow. So trying to promote and support the European Union's journey through decarbonisation in a way that both meets environmental goals but also secures the status of European industry within the global market.
And in America, we have the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, and it's broader, with climate projects only barely mentioned on the edges. How would you characterize the American bipartisan infrastructure bill? Is it a new Green Deal at all?
I think the legislation that we've seen in the U.S. takes some inspiration from the New Deal and from more recent discussions of the Green New Deal in terms of the emphasis on using the fiscal capacity of governments to support and encourage infrastructure investment, some of which has an environmental focus. But it's also very much a strategy geared towards rebuilding American industrial competitiveness in response to what's perceived as the threat of Chinese advancement in manufacturing and in other high-tech sectors. So there are certainly some environmental imperatives that are quite central to the big policies that Biden has introduced, in particular the Inflation Reduction Act, a little bit less so the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment Act. But they're also very much about, again, in a way that the EU Green Deal is too, they're also about promoting American dominance within the global economy and about continuing to grow the American economy. To do that through building up new green industries, strength in renewable industries, electric cars, things like this, and to create jobs and to stabilize the foundations of American capitalism and to secure American dominance in the international economy.
Other countries, including South Korea, took up the new Green Deal concept. What about your nation, the UK?
So the UK has seen very limited embrace of the idea of the Green New Deal. There's certainly been much more traction within the Labour Party. There was quite a bit of support for something that looked like a Green New Deal when Jeremy Corbyn was the head of the Labour Party. What we have seen with Keir Starmer in charge of the Labour Party is certainly quite a large-scale plan for transforming the industrial basis of the UK economy, large-scale investment in infrastructure to support decarbonisation and the creation of new jobs in the manufacturing sector. But again, this is shorn of many of the more progressive features of the Green New Deal as it's been discussed more intellectually as a sort of template for green transition. So again, there is no commitment to full employment. There isn't a particularly strong focus on racial justice or equality. The role of the state and of public institutions in shaping the green transition is still relatively limited. So there's some inspiration from the Green New Deal that feeds into those policies, but they're a long way from, I think, the most optimistic and ambitious interpretations of what the Green New Deal would be on the climate left. Now, the Conservative government that are in power, by contrast to the Labour Party, who are currently out of power, they've recently been backpedaling on commitments to net zero. They've expanded licenses for offshore gas exploration, and they're trying to build an electoral coalition going into the next election, which is solidified by a commitment to slow down the transition to net zero and to actually extend the use of fossil fuel energy and extraction in the United Kingdom. So they're moving in a very, very bad direction in terms of climate policy.
Oh dear, the UK goes for the Black New Deal. Well, let's get back to basics. What was the situation behind the first New Deal passed by the Roosevelt administration in the United States in 1933?
The inspiration for the original New Deal was to try and drag the American economy out of the Great Depression, which, following on from the Wall Street crash, had seen very large-scale unemployment in the U.S., complete stagnation of economic dynamism, a widespread hunger and destitution. And this was a situation that was also inspiring growing labor militancy and radicalism, and essentially threatened to disrupt the foundations of liberal capitalism in the United States. So the New Deal was an attempt to try and both escape the Depression by introducing new policies to increase the level of production and consumption in the economy, to reboot the level of economic demand, to escape the slump, but also to bring out new institutions and new policies that would try and support working class communities, and that would basically kind of increase the domestic support and political foundations of capitalism to stabilize it and to dampen the threat of socialist and anti-capitalist opposition to the U.S. economic settlement.
But when that sort of floundered, the classic New Deal took a different turn in 1937. In your paper, you write, quote, "The structuralists were surpassed by the newly ascendant Keynesian-inspired spenders, who placed greater emphasis on the need for a compensatory fiscal policy rather than structural institutional reform to escape from the Depression," end quote. And this is so important. Instead of changing the institutions that may have bred the Depression, they decided to spend their way out of it. That seems to be the approach again these days, don't you think?
Yes. So the structuralist thinkers had focused on certain problems in the institutional organization of the U.S. economy that they argued were preventing a level of economic demand, of purchasing power for workers that would transition the economy back into a higher growth state and escape the Depression. As Keynes became more influential in the transatlantic economic debate, his ideas were taken up by the U.S. economist Alvin Hansen, who had moved to Harvard University. Hansen had his own diagnosis of the ills of the Depression, what he termed secular stagnation, so a kind of long-term tendency towards stagnating economic growth brought about by a number of sort of longer-term institutional developments. But what we see from sort of 1937 onwards is people aligned with Hansen arguing and drawing on Keynes' ideas to make this argument that what was necessary to escape the Depression was actually a much larger government-backed fiscal policy that would increase the level of spending, generate demand in the economy, and reactivate a growth cycle that would help escape the Depression. So what you see here really is this idea that government spending, fiscal intervention can escape the slump, can reboot the economy into a kind of high production, high consumption equilibrium and drive economic growth. And what we see in a lot of contemporary Green New Deal discourse is a similar reliance on this, you know, fiscal investment, fiscal spending dynamic to push us through green transition, and a focus on green growth that would run alongside this, while at the same time also being aware of the need to scale back the environmentally intensive forms of consumption, of energy use that have brought us to this very, very dire environmental situation that we're currently in. So the argument I make in my paper is that a lot of Green New Deal thinking essentially borrows this spending fiscal emphasis of the New Deal era and applies it to the context of the climate crisis. But what this neglects is the fact that this Keynesian paradigm that was really sort of solidified during the 1930s is actually very much causally entangled with the deterioration of environmental conditions, with the increased use of fossil fuels in, from the 1940s onwards, in particular, what's often referred to as the Great Acceleration. So there's a deep paradox here in wanting to solve the environmental problem, which in many ways is generated by the excessive consumption imprint of wealthy classes, of Western populations in particular, and the way that that has led to rising carbon emissions and pressures on ecosystems, wanting to solve that by relying on the very toolkit that actually brought us into this situation, a toolkit that was originally developed to generate high production and high consumption in the context of an economic slump.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest from the University of Cambridge is Professor Jeremy Green. We are talking about the Green New Deal movement. Jeremy, you are a specialist in the history and operations of capitalism. Is the Green New Deal just another capitalist ploy, a last-ditch effort to save the system that makes the 1% wealthy?
I don't think that the Green New Deal is a capitalist ploy. I think many of the advocates of the Green New Deal would certainly consider themselves to be staunchly on the left politically. Some of them might even harbor ambitions to move beyond capitalism eventually. But I think many advocates of the Green New Deal see this as a pragmatic and workable way of advancing green transition within the context of the time that's available and the institutional structures that we exist within. I don't think that this is a sort of elite-driven, top-down project. Originally, it emanates in many cases from progressive thinkers, from progressive political economists, inspired by some of the progressive connotations of the original New Deal. But what we do see now that these policies or policies that are mildly derived from the Green New Deal are being enacted in countries like the United States is that certainly they are being enacted in a way that reinforces capitalism. So if we look at Biden's policies, it's very, very hard to see anything there that's going to suggest that we're going to move beyond capitalism, that we're going to move towards socialism or some kind of notion of public services, public provision and public abundance. Instead, what we're seeing is a lot of fiscal support for sectors of what we might call green capital, who are investing in things like electric cars, renewable energy, supporting these new forms of green capital in a kind of global race to lead what's really becoming a sort of industrial transformation that is supposed to move us into a decarbonized, or to move us gradually into a more decarbonized economy. So this certainly isn't a sort of anti-capitalist agenda as it's being enacted by these policymakers. But what it is doing is drawing the state back into the economy in ways that are much more pronounced and proactive and strategic than we've seen over recent decades when we've been living under the sort of hegemony of neoliberalism, which tended to emphasize the priority of the market as a mechanism for distributing resources and for steering economic development.
Well, I worry when the public is finally beaten into a call for real emergency climate action, the government will say it's broke. The money's all been spent rescuing a staggering economy, transferring zillions of dollars and pounds to giant corporations. Now the cupboard is empty. Is there a limit to the amount of Keynes' magic money for these kind of crises?
So I think that what we've seen in the pandemic and in response to the global financial crisis is that when global elites want to, they can use monetary power with extraordinary flexibility and elasticity. We saw in the pandemic entire economies being put on life support schemes while people were stuck at home and many people were not working. And that has generated a context of very large scales of debt. And what we now have is this inflationary context that's led central banks around the world to raise interest rates and tackle inflation. So on the one hand, yes, we have this great amount of flexibility in responding both to the financial crisis and then to the pandemic through using money creation via central banks, using fiscal policy and government deficits to keep up people's incomes when they weren't working, when the economy was in recession. But now that we've moved into this inflationary period, it's much more difficult to use those tools because those tools may well contrast with the imperative of curbing inflation that central banks are now prioritizing. It's difficult to see how we might get through the more kind of radical and rapid form of green transition that we need without some inflation along the way. And in fact, inflation for some sectors of the population, for their wages, would be a very good thing. So we need to think about disaggregating good inflation and bad inflation. Good inflation might be inflation that helps workers, that helps underprivileged groups, and bad inflation is the inflation that hits their living standards disproportionately. But we also need to think about taxation and fiscal policy. And one of the big problems of government policy in recent years is that there's been so much reliance on monetary policy to do the heavy lifting, and that has meant that we've relegated the emphasis on progressive taxation, on redistribution, on funding government programs in ways that are progressive and redistributive and much fairer rather than just leaving this to undemocratic central banks to intervene and drive these outcomes.
Many New Green Deal proponents focus sharply on preventing disastrous climate change, leaving out destruction of the Amazon, die-offs in the ocean, and general environmental wreckage. I think nature needs a Green New Deal, maybe rights for animals or even rivers. Jeremy Green, what are your thoughts?
So I think you're absolutely right to point to the fact that the Green New Deal, as a kind of emergent paradigm of thought, is primarily focused on the problem of decarbonization. And to some extent, of course, that makes sense because the timeline for decarbonization and for driving down CO2 emissions is the most acute, the most severe in terms of its impact on wider Earth system dynamics. So it does make sense to strategically prioritize decarbonization. But at the same time, we have to recognize that this is a much deeper crisis of the entanglement between capitalism and nature and ecosystems, and that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that we are stressing and straining planetary boundaries across a number of dimensions, not just on the dimension of global warming and emissions. So I think what the Green New Deal often evades is a kind of deeper reckoning with how we think about what the economy is and how it relates to the environment, how it relates to ecosystems. And, of course, that's evidenced by the way that it seeks to sort of repurpose this Keynesian idea of the macroeconomy and use that to work through green transition, while neglecting the fact that, of course, people like Keynes and his contemporaries didn't really think that much about the environmental embeddedness or effects of economic growth. So thinking about rights for nature, thinking about how we foreground the importance of ecosystems, of sustainable coexistence between human society and the natural world, I think this is absolutely vital for a much deeper and more transformative sense of what green transition is that takes us beyond just moving into new forms of industrial modernization, the shift to renewables, the turn to electric vehicles. What we see in the emerging green transition discourse and policy is essentially an attempt to maintain our high production, high consumption lifestyles, but to transfer those onto a renewable energy basis. And I think that really skirts the problem of just how intense the impact of the expansion of our economies, of our lifestyles, have been on the environment. We simply cannot continue to live with these ideas of privatized abundance and limitlessness. We need to think much more about forms of planetary stewardship that are about resource conservation and about principles of sufficiency and also resource distribution from the global north to the global south.
In a 2021 paper reviewing Green New Deal and degrowth, Ricardo Mastini, Callis, and Hickel suggest, quote, despite important tensions, there is room for synthesizing Green New Deal and degrowth-minded approaches into a Green New Deal without growth. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting idea. I mean, I think one way that you could think about that is to say that, well, the Green New Deal's emphasis on the importance of the state as an actor, on the value of public involvement, public investment, on goals of equality, on provision of basic services. So these ideas are very present in much of the progressive discussion of the Green New Deal. The problem is that they're often attached to this sort of reified attempt to just reproduce economic growth while not taking seriously enough the environmental consequences of that strategy. I think that the degrowth perspective on the Green New Deal is to say, well, look, we like lots of those points of emphasis and we recognize the need for the state to intervene and to do some of these policies on a big scale. But actually, we need to recognize that some sectors of the economy do need to degrow. Those that are most carbon intensive, those that are most ecologically damaging, do need to be scaled back. But of course, we can think potentially about some form of expansion of areas of economic and social activity which have a much more sustainable foundation. But I think in order to do this, we really do need to kind of break beyond the paradigm of 20th century macroeconomic thought that guides the Green New Deal, that of course emerged around the time of the New Deal. So I think that we need to combine some of the emphasis of degrowth on scaling back activities and sectors that are particularly catastrophic in terms of carbon emissions, in terms of their environmental imprint. But we also need to connect that to a kind of broader way of understanding how we can concert these changes across the scales of national economies and then also the global economy.
As we wrap up, Jeremy Green, what are you working on these days?
I'm currently working on a new project which examines the relationship between liberal ideas of money and institutions of international money, so thinking about the classical gold standard and Bretton Woods, for example, and the way in which these ideas and institutions of money have been entangled with forms of extractivism and have facilitated production, consumption, fossil fuel use across the 20th century. So what I'm trying to develop here is a way of thinking about the origins of the Great Acceleration and of the Anthropocene through the prism of money as a socio-economic technology. And my hope is that by thinking about this historically and theoretically, that might also provide some clues and prompts for understanding how we might reconfigure money and our systems of money to deal with the problem of green transition and to develop economies, economic systems that are much less reliant on ideas of growth and perpetual expansion.
From the University of Cambridge, we've been speaking with political economy professor Jeremy Green. Find links to his open access paper, Greening Keynes, Productivist Lineages of the Green New Deal, in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Jeremy, thank you for helping out our Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you very much for hosting me. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Mass media is overloading with death and violence, while good people are told to shelter in place. Beneath the waves of the latest attacks, a human engine continues to devour the planet and all its species, pumping waste into land, sea, and atmosphere. This program reports that deeper layer below the waves, the drivers of chaotic reality. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our world. We go out with a bit of I Didn't Start the Fire by the Torquay Girls Grammar School in Devon, UK.
Grab the thunder, bang the drum, causes pandemonium, global warming, climate change, 1.5 degrees. Carbon footprint, biomass, fossil fuels and greenhouse gas, methane, CO2, CFCs. Glaciers, ice caps, melting snow, shrinking maps, Maldives, rising seas, widespread famine and disease. Amazon, Borneo, Armageddon, embers glow, slash and burn, no return, there's chainsaws in the Congo. We didn't start the fire, but now it's really burning and the temperature's turning. We didn't start the fire, no we didn't light it, but we're trying to fight it. Flash floods, danger zones, hurricanes and cyclones. Wildfires, burning past pollution in our seas. Skies are blackening, oceans full of packaging. Shout it out, there's no doubt, nature's on its knees. Attenborough, Donald Trump, climate champion, climate chump. Skeptics still deny the proof of an inconvenient truth. Reduce, reuse, recycle, no excuse. Act now, face the truth, it's the challenge of our youth. Point. Warning gong, ding dong, how did it go so wrong? Rise up nationwide, stop the rot, turn the tide, be strong, live long, listen to our earth song. We didn't start the fire, but now it's really burning and the temperature's turning. We didn't start the fire, no we didn't light it, but we're trying to find it.
Climate change is real, and although we didn't start the fire, it is us who feel the heat.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.